Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's bombs away over Libya this week, a harrowing struggle still in Japan, GOP hopefuls on the move, and a sleepy air traffic controller. The no-fly zone and more came down over Libya. Muammar Gaddafi was defiant, Hillary Clinton defensive, determined.
Great Libyan people, you are now living through glorious hours. All the people are with us. We will have a revolution against imperialism.
A massacre in Benghazi was prevented. Gaddafi's air force and air defenses have been rendered largely ineffective, and the coalition is in control of the skies above Libya.
Anxiety in Japan over warnings of tap water contaminated by radiation. Here's one Tokyo resident worried about her baby.
I have just had another baby, and I fear my baby can be affected through contaminated breast milk. That's why I think I should use bottled water for everything, including making rice for myself.
And an air traffic controller at Reagan National Airport in Washington asleep on the job Wednesday night, leaving two pilots to land with the tower apparently unmanned.
Tower is apparently unmanned. Called on the phones, and nobody's answering, so that aircraft went in.
Went in as an uncontrolled airport. This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Jonathan Martin, senior political reporter at Politico, Rula Khalaf, Mideast editor for the Financial Times in London, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation, what are you thinking on Libya, on Japan, Tim Pawlenty, Michelle Bachmann, the snoozy air traffic guy. You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Jonathan Martin, it's great to have you with us. Thanks so much.
It's good being here. Thanks for having me.
Rula Khalaf in London. Welcome back, Rula. Thank you for joining us today.
Nice to be with you.
And hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Let's get right into this no-fly zone over Libya. Came last weekend. Suddenly it was wings up and all kinds of American and British and French air power over that country. By Tuesday, President Obama was being asked to defend those strikes. Here he is at a press conference in El Salvador, saying that a major humanitarian disaster had been averted because Gaddafi's forces were prevented from going into Benghazi.
Obviously, there are always risks involved in this kind of operation, but for us to be able to structure something where we bring our unique capabilities to bear to fulfill a mission that is supported by the international community against somebody who was about to direct his armed forces against his people in the most vicious of ways is something that I think the American people and certainly our American military should be proud of.
But questions had come very early here. Here's Senator Richard Lugar, Republican, Indiana, telling CNN's John King on Monday already he didn't understand President Obama's goals in Libya.
This situation really needs clarification of a plan and objectives, some definition of how the United States plans to be involved, either with European powers, because NATO is not going to be involved given the Turkish veto.
Well, maybe not, but here we are at the end of the week, and NATO's certainly involved, at least in the no-fly zone. Rula Khalaf, how would you describe the situation now in and over Libya at the end of almost week one of the no-fly zone, Rula?
I think on the one hand, the military action, the Western military action, has been able to progressively destroy both air defenses and some of the other ground equipment in Libya, but I don't see yet any real movement on the part of the Gaddafi regime. Definitely, the major achievement is that the attack on Benghazi was prevented. Last weekend, if you remember, Gaddafi's forces were already going into town, and you know, by Sunday something had to be done, or they could have retaken Benghazi. So that is the major achievement, I would say, this week, after a whole week of airstrikes. On the other hand, the rebels have not been able to retake Ajdabiya, which is about 100 kilometers from Benghazi, despite, you know, more than, I think, at least 2 days of airstrikes on Gaddafi forces around. And Misrata in the west is another town that rebels have not been able to retake. So I think, you know, some people might be disappointed by the impact of the airstrikes, but it might also be, as you know, Robert Gates said yesterday or the day before, that this is just going to take much longer than people expected.
Jonathan Martin in Washington. Here we are, nearly at the end of week one of No Fly Zone Plus. What are we? What is the Obama administration in for here in Libya, Jonathan?
Well, I think that they're obviously in for the coalition, and they are hesitant about leading the coalition, as has been made clear. But they have been a little bit all over the map when it comes to Gaddafi himself. But I think it's now pretty clear that they do in fact want Gaddafi to step down. Although last weekend you saw some comments from Chairman of the Joint Chiefs Mike Mullen saying it's possible that, you know, we could do this whole operation and that Gaddafi could still be in power. Now, the president has subsequently made clear that he wants Gaddafi out, but I think there has been some confusion about what the ultimate end game here is. And there's been more than a little bit of sniping from members of Congress. And what's so striking about it is it hasn't been from the left or the right. It's been from the left, the middle, and the right all over the map. You know, what all members of Congress agree on, regardless of their political stripe, is that they want to be relevant. They want to be in the game. And any time that you go forward with a major military intervention like this, and Congress does not feel like they have been adequately informed, you're going to have this kind of second-guessing from Capitol Hill.
Jack Beatty, what do you see here? Is the U.S. now, at this point, in for weeks, for months, for the duration of a civil war? Do we have any idea?
We don't. I mean, it's desolating to realize that the no-fly zone in Iraq went for 12 years, and it did not dislodge Saddam Hussein. So if the idea is the no-fly zone will somehow, you know, there'll be a coup behind the lines that'll get rid of Gaddafi, the Iraq model is not encouraging. Well, what about arming the rebels? John McCain has called for that, but that has its own complications. And then I've even read that the rebels are talking about hiring American mercenaries, advisors, to show them how to use the weaponry and so on. I thought the key point this week was made by Eugene Robinson in a single sentence. He said the goal must be to prevent the bloodbath, not just reschedule it. Well, it was prevented at least this week. But with Gaddafi in power, people in his cities are going to be subject to his cruelties. And if they happen beneath the, you know, what CNN can show, I suppose they can go on. If they're more visible, as in Misrata, which is apparently the conditions are deteriorating there, mm-hmm. according to our people, then the pressure to do more, I think, will increase. To me, the really impressive thing also this week is we really have seen the emergence of an Obama doctrine. And it really comes down to you guys have got to do more to NATO. You know, 10 years ago, the U.S. contributed half of the spending in the alliance. Now that we spend 75% of the spending. This has got to stop, and I think the president has finally said to the allies, you want to do it? Okay, you take it from here.
Rula Khalaf, give us the advantage of you being there in London, closer to NATO headquarters, France, Britain, all the rest. Alain Juppé, the French foreign minister, has talked about weeks or months, I think, in Libya at this point. If there's confusion in Washington about exactly what the timetable and goals are here, what about, let's start in London. Is there confusion there or clarity?
No. I think you can say that there's confusion everywhere. This is an operation that was started with a very broadly defined goal, which is we're going to protect civilians. And the UN essentially wrote a blank check for how you, you protect civilians, because they said you can use all the necessary measures. And given that there isn't really any agreement on what these measures are, there are a lot of very big decisions that are going to have to be taken. It seems to me that the U.S. has been very much involved in the first phase, but is now passing the leadership and the decision-making, a lot of the decision-making, onto the Europeans and also the Arabs. But I think on Libya, you've got two key powers here, Britain and France. They're the ones who've been clamoring from the start for outside intervention.
Are they prepared to sustain?
They are facing the same issues that, you know, we've just heard President Obama is facing. How far do you go? What if in 3-4 weeks, Gaddafi's still there? He's got his tanks in some of the cities. Therefore, you cannot bomb. You can't get rid of them because you don't want to. You don't want to inflict civilian casualties. Mm-hmm. And I think that's when, you know, you have to start deciding, what do you do? Do you arm the rebels? Do you take this a step further? And do you, you know, put all your weight behind the rebels and, you know, take sides in what will have to be a civil war for a while if you want to try to get them to then go all the way to Tripoli to unseat Gaddafi. So I think there are some very, very big decisions down the road.
And Rula, very quickly, before
nothing happens, if there's no coup against Gaddafi, if, you know, no one tries to kill him, or, I mean, there are, I think, a lot of hopes in the international community that something's going to give, that someone's going to get rid of him, or there will be mass defections, and that he will be removed from power.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Some from Yemen there. Unrest across the Arab world again this week, not just in Libya, certainly not. And then there's Israel's situation to look at. We're looking at a week in the news. The U.S. and allies hit Libya. President Obama in the hot seat over that. GOP hopefuls toe-dipping on 2012. And Japan struggling on. Jonathan Martin of Politico joins us from Washington, senior political reporter there. Rula Khalaf joins us from London, Middle East editor for the Financial Times. Jack Beatty's here. Rula, I'm afraid we're still in the cockpit with you here, looking around this region. I mean, so much going on. The firing on and killing of 50-some protesters in Yemen, then the military seeming to defect from the leader there, Syria, where you don't hear about big uprising demonstrations a lot this week. Bahrain still rumbling. We'll look at Israel. But what about the so-called Arab wave? And we'll come to Egypt. But across the region, Rula, is this thing still on, this wave of change?
I think, judging by the events this week, yes, it is still on. It seems to me that in Yemen we're approaching an end game. In fact, the president said today that he would be willing to step down, but under conditions. And it would appear that he's trying to negotiate his exit. What he wants in return is not yet very, very clear to me, but I think, you know, we do seem to be approaching the end game, particularly as a few days ago there were some of the some major defections, a top commander, but also tribal leaders. So I think this is a story that will develop in very fast in the next few days. The other interesting thing this week, I think, was Syria, because this is, you know, after Tunisia and Libya, this is probably today the most repressive state in the Middle East, and people are truly, there are constant arrests of human rights activists. There is no real opposition anymore in Damascus. And very interestingly, this was the events in Syria were started in Daraa. It's an agricultural town. Mm-hmm. And what happened was that just a bunch of school children had painted some graffiti on the wall of of town, there were just slogans that they'd been seeing on TV from the other uprisings, things like, you know, the people want the regime to fall.
Right, right.
And they were arrested, and this is what triggered the anger of the people of Deraa. Today, there does seem to be several demonstrations across the country, but small. So I think it's still difficult. To figure out where this is going to go. And there's been a very harsh crackdown. Some figures that we've seen, I mean, anywhere from 40 to 100 people have been killed, according to human rights activists. And that's just in 7 days of protests.
And this from Syria, where we're not accustomed to hearing that kind of number, that kind of uprising, at least not lately. Egypt, Israel, you name it. Here on Egypt over the weekend, in Egypt, that referendum on a new constitutional amendments there. Here's a 30-year-old woman telling Al Jazeera why she was out voting.
I never considered voting before, but I knew this time I could make a difference. So I thought, I'm an Egyptian. I have to have a voice. It's my right.
It's my right. And here out of Israel, the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu talking with reporters in the wake of Wednesday's bus station bombing in Jerusalem, saying that his government would respond forcefully.
People have enjoyed a quiet period thanks to our policy of responding vigorously to attacks. Those trying to test our resolve will learn we have an iron will to defend ourselves. We will act sharply and responsibly to maintain security.
Jonathan Martin in Washington, do you have the sense of the Obama administration, or Congress for that matter, on top of this kind of pan-regional upheaval here? Or are events just running out in front of policy at this point?
Oh, I think it's very difficult for the folks both in the White House and on Capitol Hill to assess what's going on here because, like you said, it is really defying imagination at this point. Look, if you had talked to the top congressional leaders and President Obama's senior advisors back at the start of the year, mm-hmm. they would have told you that what was going to dominate the landscape in the first half of 2011 was going to be the economy and trying to get unemployment down, taking on spending.
Right.
And of course, the future always outwits our certitudes, as Schlesinger mm-hmm. once said. Mm-hmm. And the fact is we're juggling now this extraordinary upheaval across the Mideast. I don't know exactly how President Obama is going to deal with this in the future. I mean, so far it seems like his strategy has been very carefully calibrated given the different circumstances in each of the various countries. But what does happen if this does spread into a place like Saudi Arabia? If the actions taking place right now in Syria and Damascus do get worse, if there's more, you know, just wanton killings of demonstrators mm-hmm. in Damascus, I mean, how do we juggle that? Syria, I mean, it's a very tough question. So I don't know if any of these folks have a grip as to what exactly is next. And again, what's fascinating is this is crossing partisan lines. There's not a D and an R view of this. They are mixed views across the board. So it's well beyond party at this point.
Beyond party, but certainly we've got some wild geopolitical chemistry heading into the very early moves in the 2012 presidential campaign. Here's a little bit from Michelle Bachmann, Republican Congresswoman, Minnesota, in an interview on Fox News yesterday, criticizing the Obama administration's handling of the situation in Libya, maybe beyond.
There's so many uncertainties, and one of the first phrases that came from the administration is that Gaddafi must go. And in the same breath, it was, but it's okay if he stays. There's so much incoherence that's coming from the administration right now that it's difficult to comprehend what their thinking was in going forward with this, because we don't know what the end game will be.
Jack Beatty, we've gone into election seasons with war in this region, in one nation, in two nations. But the idea of going into a big political season with this whole region up for grabs looks pretty wild. What do you see out there, Jack?
It is wild. You know, I mean, no one can control this. That's the nature of revolution. It's like a chain reaction in physics. There's no stopping it. And, of course, the tragic geometry of revolutions going the circle is part of that. You know, there's always that possibility. And we read in today's Times, for example, that the Muslim Brotherhood is really sitting pretty pretty with the military in Egypt. People were saying just weeks ago, oh, forget about them. Well, according to the Times, they have a very lead role there now. I'm not saying that that means the end of the revolution. I'm just saying that's one of the kinds of imponderables, the developments that are coming. I think the president has been, if he's been confused, I think he's been modeling reality. Reality is confusing. If the president has been saying we can't stand at the front of events and lead all the time and be in charge of everything, I think that's just a reflection of who and what we are. And if he's saying to the allies, you people, if you really want to do this, have to take over this no-fly zone or play a larger role, that also is part of the post-Iraq reality. Madeleine Albright this week said Iraq has undermined American feeling about intervention. And the president, I think, is reacting to that.
Modeling reality in a little confusion. Let's hear from our listeners, Jack, Rula, Jonathan. Len is calling from Jackson, Kentucky. Hi, Len. You're on the air. Thanks for calling, Len.
Thank you for taking the call. Mm-hmm. Listen, when has a no-fly zone ever not developed in the boots on the ground? Kosovo, no-fly zone, boots on the ground. Iraq, no-fly zone, boots on the ground. So if the coalition doesn't develop an endgame plan right here, right now, we're going to have boots on the ground.
Would you favor that, or are you against it, Len?
You know, to accomplish the mission, you almost have to do that. But, you know, the politicos and all the talking heads are going, well, it'd just be a no-fly zone. You know, no danger to us, you know.
Yep.
175 million worth of cruise missiles to start the thing. But eventually, you're going to have to put boots on the ground to accomplish the mission. All wars are won with boots on the ground.
Len, we've got it. Let me get one more right here. Beverly in Ashland, Massachusetts. Beverly, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm an advocate for the military, and I bless every day for them because they're the best in the world. There's no one like our
okay.
military.
Yep.
And I'm an advocate for the Americans, and I tell you, we're going into quicksand. We need to bring our troops home. We need, I said originally, with Iraq and Afghanistan, let the people evacuate where they can, go to their neighboring countries, and just get in there, you know. But I never wanted a war. They need a talk Congress, and that's what they get paid for. And America's going down the tubes. Our military is overstressed, and we need to talk to these other countries that can help. And we've overdone our stay in all these countries. It's just going to get worse.
Beverly, we've got a salute to the military, but bring them home, you say. Let me get one more right here. Nashville, Tennessee, Carl. Carl, you're on the air.
You know, I tell you, here in America, the hypocrites on the right never cease to amaze me. First of all, Brazil is one of the fastest growing economies in the world. They complain about President Obama being down in Brazil trying to get jobs, something that they talked about in nauseam for months and months and months leading up to the election. And now something has happened that I never thought I'd see in my 40 years of life, Republicans and conservatives going against military action. First Newt Gingrich was for it, and then he was against it. That proves the fact that these people are against anything that President Obama do, even if it's their positions. Absolutely amazing.
Carl, we've got it. Jonathan Martin, let me bring that one to you. The GOP on Libya. It's going to be sitting there for some time now. Newt Gingrich, you know, March 7th, saying, you know, get in there. Yeah. This week saying, I would not have intervened. How do you see this playing in those quarters?
Well, forgive my flattery for a moment, but can I just real fast put a plug in for NPR? Those three callers from our great country, Jackson, Kentucky, Nashville, Tennessee, and Beverly, Mass. On the North Shore.
You got it?
Just smart, smart, insightful, and it's just a pleasure to listen to, and I think it reflects NPR at its best. As to your question, I think they are struggling to get a handle on this. The neoconservative wing of the GOP has taken hold. That is the default view right now within the Republican Party. The sort of Buchananite isolationist wing has faded. It's still there, but it is greatly diminished. So you now have a default position of always favoring intervention. But what happens when the interventionist is President Obama? It puts them in a tough spot. So what you're seeing is a lot of them saying, well, this wasn't soon enough, or President Obama dithered. So they're criticizing the mechanics of it, but they're not criticizing the underlying policy necessarily. The one interesting exception in all of this is Governor Barbour from down in Mississippi, who is a very much a traditional, you know, establishment, Chamber of Commerce kind of Republican.
Yeah, Haley Barbour,
but, yeah. But who has said here that he is concerned about our commitments abroad, that he doesn't want to be in the business of nation building. How much further can we go? We have Afghanistan and Iraq already. So I think it's going to be a really fascinating thing to watch to see if he tries to find a foothold with some of the Republicans who, even though they're, you know, supportive of the military, they support the use of force, they are starting to get a bit weary of all of our commitments abroad at a time of economic distress at home.
Hard to find exactly where to put that foot. Newt Gingrich saying, again, on March 7th, it looked like we ought to be in there this week. Here he was with NBC's Matt Lauer on Wednesday.
I would not have intervened. I think there were a lot of other ways to affect Gaddafi. I think there are a lot of allies in the region that we could have worked with. I would not have used American and European forces.
Well, not this week. Anyway, Jerry in Cookeville, Tennessee. Jerry, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, hello, Tom.
Hi.
Well, first off, I just said about Newt Gingrich. Really, what he says really doesn't matter to me because he has really no no skin in the game right now. I'll just kind of paraphrase what Secretary of Defense said earlier this week. He said, we're kind of doing this on the fly.
Yes, he did.
We've never done anything like this before, the way that they're handling this military mission. But what's happening in Egypt, I noticed Jack brought that up about the article in the Times this morning. Now, they're going to crack down on people protesting in sit-ins. And there's a lot of worrying in this country about what's happening with Israel.
Sure.
Several weeks ago, it really wasn't reported in our news, about a family that was massacred in their home. Their throats were sliced.
We saw this. These were settlers on the West Bank, apparently by Palestinian attackers, one assumes.
Right. And so that really wasn't reported much in our country.
Well.
And so I imagine when Israel, they are going to... they are going to move heavy, and when they do, there's going to be calls for no-fly zones against Israel. So I just wonder if the American people are going to stand up for Israel or for the Muslim Brotherhood, which is taking over Egypt. And by the way, I believe some people on your panel kind of disregarded that when people brought it up earlier.
Well, I mean, everybody was scratching their head and trying to figure out. Jerry, I appreciate your call. Rula Khalaf, I mean, this is quite a picture right now. The rockets have come out of Gaza again into Israeli territory, the bombing in Jerusalem. There are people murmuring about whether or not Israel may really go hard at Gaza again. We could see that at the same time you've got, just after these elections in Egypt, reports of the Muslim Brotherhood's rising influence there. Let's take that one first, Rula. Do you buy that? Or is the, you know, sort of young secular Twitter crowd already sidelined here? Is it the Muslim Brotherhood plus the military in Egypt? Is that the future?
Well, I think that there's a very grave danger of simplifying far too much.
Mm-hmm.
These are very complex times. This is all very new.
Yep.
It's new to the people in the region, and it's new to policymakers outside. And I think that people, and a lot is going on, so there's a lot to digest and to analyze. And I think people do need to be a bit careful in what they assume to be the case. Let's take Egypt, for example. You've got a military who took over after helping to push President Mubarak aside. Now, the military appears to feel more comfortable dealing with, the sort of older generation from the Muslim Brotherhood, because this is one organization that they know they can deal with. This was a revolution that was that came from youth groups. These, you know, they are still not terribly organized. And I don't think that one can assume from now that the revolution has completely been hijacked by the Muslim Brotherhood. I think the Muslim Brotherhood is being given an advantage, largely because the army doesn't know how to manage the transition.
Rula, hold the thought if you would. No assumptions here, just trying to figure it all out, and so much going on. Rula Khalaf in London, please stand by. Jonathan Martin in Washington, Jack Beatty. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, a big wildfire near Golden, Colorado. Rowdy Muir, fire commander, says a blaze this size is unusual this time of year.
And this is the earliest my team's ever been mobilized in 9 years. If we don't see any moisture this spring, I think you're going to see a lot of fire.
The great Elizabeth Taylor died early Wednesday. She was 79. Here she is, marvelous at 12 in the 1944 hit National Velvet.
I want to be a famous rider. I should like to hunt, ride to hounds. I should like to race. I should like to have so many horses that I could walk down between the loose boxes and ride what I choose.
And on the teen YouTube front, heads bobbing and shaking over 13-year-old Rebecca Black's quirky breakout music video, Friday.
It's Friday, Friday, gotta get down on Friday. Everybody looking forward to the weekend, weekend, Friday.
We're looking at a week in the news. The U.S. and allies hit Libya. President Obama in the hot seat. GOP hopefuls toe dip on 2012. And Japan struggling on. We're joined by Jonathan Martin of Politico, Rula Khalaf in London with the Financial Times, and our own Jack Beattie. Let's go right to Nina in Buffalo, New York. Nina, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, I just wanted to make a point about the problem at the Reagan Airport. I don't know if anyone else has seen the irony in this, that it happened at Reagan Airport with the air traffic controllers, that it was Ronald Reagan who in 1981 fired the striking air traffic controllers, creating a very perilous situation. So it's somewhat appropriate and very ironic.
Right, to break the air traffic union, and decades later, there's one guy in the tower at midnight. I don't know, Jonathan, what are there politics of the Reagan National Control Tower, Jonathan?
Oh, yeah, I think organized labor has definitely perked its ears up and said, look, this is why we need to have, more rules and more workers up there. We should have two folks in these towers at all times. So they've definitely caught wind of this. I should say, for purposes of full disclosure, yep, I actually flew into National that night. I arrived at about 10 p.m. on a flight from Memphis on Delta, and I think that was probably about 2 hours before the fellow asleep. So I think all was well with me.
Nothing would wake this guy. Even the squawk box, other people calling in over loudspeakers saying, hey, what's going on there? Here's a pilot and attorney, Mike Pangea, explaining, this is on the NBC, why there should have been at least two air traffic controllers in that tower on the night when the sole controller fell asleep.
The job becomes very, very tedious, not because of the amount of traffic, but because of the lack of traffic, and it engenders complacency. So you need two people in that tower at an airport like this airport.
Tedious, unless you're on that plane and trying to get down. Let's go to Shane in Lancaster, South Carolina. Shane, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've just got one quick question, and that is, what is so far of our involvement in Libya? While I agree that the humanitarian crisis is severe, I can't help but wonder if we would be involved if not for their oil reserves. And I would like to know what those hundreds of fusion missiles at hundreds of millions apiece could have done for our public school system in the middle of this financial crisis here domestically.
Shane, what about when President Obama says, oh, well, we're sharing the burden this time? It's not just the United States. How does that ring to you?
Well, it rings kind of false to me. This is going on in countries all over the world, but Libya has strategic oil reserves that we have an interest in. And yet again, our public school system is faltering dramatically. Teachers have incredible cuts nationwide, and these missiles are hundreds of millions apiece. What would that simple budget that we've spent in the past week alone have done as an injection into our school system?
Shane, I'm going to bring that right in the conversation. One more call first, if I may. Michigan, Owosso, Michigan. Dave, you're on the air. Hi, Dave.
How you doing?
Pretty well.
Good. My question largely is, and this is something I've been thinking about since this all started happening, is who exactly in Libya and in the Middle East are we helping? I don't think that either force, the United States or the United Nations, has ever clearly taken the steps to define that. I think they've left it loose and, tried to get us to swallow things. But one of the things I'm looking at is, you talk about the rebels, you talk about the groups and them being disorganized. And so I find it kind of troubling that we're sending all this military force in there without exactly knowing who it is we're dealing with, who we're empowering, and exactly who it is that we're helping.
Dave in Michigan, I've got it. And I want to come back to Shane on the question of cost and domestic priorities. But Rula Khalaf, let me come to you on this one first, because this question keeps bubbling up. We've thrown air cover over a civil war here now. The question remains, who's on the rebel side?
Do you feel confident, watching, looking, as Mideast editor out of London, that this is still the kind of secular opposition that we saw rise up in Tunisia and Egypt?
I don't know if this is a secular opposition. I'm sure that this is an opposition. These are very ordinary people. A lot of them are professionals. They're lawyers, they're doctors. And this started as an uprising in the very same way that Tunisia and Egypt developed, except that when they were met with force, and when some of the army officers defected, this became an armed uprising. But this is not how it started. And I think when people look at who is the West helping, I think they are helping people who tried to rise against Gaddafi and were met with very brutal force, and therefore were forced to take up arms. So I don't think there's much confusion there. Where there is confusion is in the organization of the rebels today. And that is, I mean, that's perfectly normal. You wouldn't expect a country that's been under 40 years of one-man rule to suddenly, you know, develop into institutions and into a very organized opposition.
Jonathan, I want to come back to Chasing Monsters Abroad and the cost of that. Shane in South Carolina, his call, and really the question that comes out of that about how all this might play as we head into the 2012 campaign season. This was a week for announcements on that front. Former Minnesota Governor Tim Pawlenty announced on Facebook he was forming a presidential exploratory committee, the new coming out step. He's the first serious contender in the 2012 exploratory committee, that is, in the 2012 nomination to take that step. Here's a clip from his video announcement.
We can restore limited government in America. It takes fortitude. It takes unwavering faith and conviction in the principles that made this country great. This country was founded on freedom. We, the people of the United States, will take back our government. This is our country. Our founding fathers created it.
Wow, that's quite the symphony soundtrack for an exploratory committee. But Jonathan Martin, I mean, that's mom and apple pie and, you know, founding freedoms. What's going to play here? You've been writing that there's this emerging GOP 2012 theme of American decline.
Right.
What's the antidote? Go into Libya or go into schools?
I think the antidote, if you're talking to a GOP activist, is just get rid of Obama and that will take care of all the problems.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
That's a glib answer, but it's not totally far off given the appetite among Republicans right now to get rid of this president. So I think that's what they're going to say. But you're right. When you do get into specifics, I think that even the Republican Party is not unified. Look, you go to a place like Iowa, which traditionally is not very hawkish, and I think there is some real concern about military adventurism, regardless of party. Of course, other parts of the country, the GOP is much more hawkish. So there's not a great consensus when it comes to foreign policy. There is consensus, I think, when it comes to fiscal issues. Just cut spending and cut taxes. I mean, I think it's a pretty simple catechism right now for these candidates. But the question, of course, is who? A lot of Republicans are concerned about their field. You hear Jeb Bush, you hear Chris Christie, you hear Paul Ryan. There is seemingly a flavor of the month here on a regular basis because they're just not happy with the candidates that they have.
What about the two exploratory announcements this week, Pawlenty and Michelle Bachmann? Give us a little thumbnail. Who are they?
The Minnesota Twins. the first thing to know is that that Bachmann served in the state Senate when Pawlenty was governor. So these folks know each other.
Yeah.
They're not terribly fond of each other. Bachmann, traditional movement conservative, somebody who is a born-again Christian, very much at the sort of vanguard of the Tea Party. She chairs the Tea Party caucus in the House, something of a provocateur, but she can raise a lot of money. She has a great feel for the grassroots of her party. Via direct mail, via the internet, she's going to be able to raise a lot of cash if she does get into this race. Keep this in mind. For her House reelection last year, she raised $13.5 million.
Okay.
That is a lot of cash for a House reelection. Pawlenty, a more conventional Republican, center-right, two-term governor of a bluish state, somebody who's going to really run on his blue-collar credentials, make a play for downscale GOP voters and try and become the Mitt Romney alternative. His big state is Iowa. He's got to break out in Iowa. But Bachmann, though, could present some problems for him there, because she is going to get so much buzz and so much attention. Now, that might not translate into votes necessarily, but she's going to cause him some problems, I think, in Iowa.
And then there's this guy, real estate mogul apprentice host Donald Trump, saying he might be a candidate for 2012 GOP. He'll decide by June, he says. Asked about that on ABC's The View Wednesday, here he explained why he'd run.
I think the country is doing so badly, they want somebody that's going to help it. I think the country has never been in a position like it is right now. It's being ripped off by every nation, every intelligent nation in the world.
The Donald might run for president as a Republican. Jack Beatty, what do you see emerging in the Republican field here?
Well, I see a refreshing candidate in Mr. Pawlenty, blue-collar background, St. Paul. His father was a truck driver. His mother died at 16, and he takes that message forward. His biographer says he attended state school, shoots guns, and prays with his family. That's a pretty good recommendation.
All right.
And he calls himself, he says, I want the GOP to be the party of Sam's Club, not the country club. And in his speeches, he's been talking, he says, at a young age, I saw up close the face of challenge, the face of hardship, and the face of job loss. I know what Americans are feeling. I've lived it. So that gives him a point of contact with the people and with their economic circumstances. Now, whether he can somehow parlay that into a genuine appeal, we don't know. It's interesting. He's had to do some flip-flopping to get ready for this. He, in 2007, he seemed to be for cap and trade, yep. And now he's almost gone over to climate change denial. So he's had to make himself ready for a GOP primary.
What do you say, Jonathan?
I was going to say, doesn't that illustrate, though, just how further to the right the party base has gone right now? I mean, Pawlenty cannot even get away with one example of apostasy. He's got to flip to get right with the party on climate change. And this is right now a party that is going to demand adherence to, you know, all the conservative sort of catechism.
The whole oil-producing Mideast is just going wild.
I think that's what the party is in the Obama era, that they've really been radicalized here in the past few years. Fast point on Pawlenty, though, and Jack really touched on this.
Okay.
His appeal is very process-oriented. I mean, it means it's less about a policy vision and less about issues than it is about persona and matters like being a blue-collar guy, I feel your pain.
Yep.
It's much more aimed at saying, I'm not a rich guy like Romney. I'm somebody that has had tough times. And it's squarely aimed at the downscale element of the Republican coalition, which is a growing element. And it's aimed at those folks in the case that Huckabee and Palin don't run, and those 75K income or less per year Republicans need somewhere to go. Plenty's going after them. But he's going after them purely on biography, not on policy.
He is campaigning in a Carhartt bar. Barncoat shades of Scott Brown there. Dave in Stowe, New Hampshire. Dave, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm actually in Stowe, Mass.
Okay. What do you know?
I don't know if there is a Stowe, New Hampshire.
I don't either.
Doesn't matter.
Okay.
Listen, I work in the energy conservation, renewable energy field. I've been there for over 30 years. And having listened to the discussion about the nuclear power plant in the problems in Japan,
yeah.
I've been really distressed because I've continued to hear all of the same old, without a new vision for where we ought to go.
Well, people were saying, let's go nuclear about 2 weeks ago, Dave.
Well, yes, they are. And what's interesting is that, and the Republicans are pushing this. On the surface, it looks like...
So did President Obama.
Well, yes, that's true. A flip-flop, a very disappointing one. But here's what I wanted to say.
Mm-hmm.
The Union of Concerned Scientists right there in Cambridge just came out with a 150-page report that nuclear has never been even remotely cost-effective. And we've got a whole party promoting this energy source, and they're the ones that are worried about fiscal irresponsibility. The alternatives are incredible. In terms of renewables and conservation, we haven't even touched the surface, and the industry's going crazy with that.
Dave,
and
our time is short. Let me look at that right there. Look at renewables. You say not nuclear. Of course, let's just hear a little out of Japan, and it wasn't nice this week. Today, a broadcast on NHK. Hidehiko Nishiyama, the Deputy Director General of the Japan Nuclear and Industrial Safety Agency, talking about those workers in the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant. They got in trouble with their feet in bad water. Here he is.
When we look into the composition of the water, The source of the water seems to be the reactor core.
It may still be going down, highly radioactive. Rula, give us a little global view there. What about in UK territory or across the channel in France? Are people going south on nuclear power as they watch Japan, Rula?
I think so. I think we had a story today, for instance, about the French, a very big debate in France about whether what, you know, the strategy that they've had should be reviewed, although the conclusion was that it probably won't. But I think, yes, absolutely, this has been a very big theme in Europe this week.
Our prayers still with Japan as they struggle with that. Jack, I don't want to go without saying a little more about Elizabeth Taylor. Speaking of, I don't know, Mother Earth, I mean, she went from a sex siren to something bigger and grander than that. Just your thoughts, Jack, on what has gone with Elizabeth Taylor's passing this week, what she stood for.
Well, you know, she combined both glamour and classical acting. I mean, listen to that voice we had on earlier, that sort of high British voice and that enunciation. She carried that through her whole career. You could listen to her movies and be delighted. And, of course, when you watched them, you had additional pleasures. and she had the big roles, you know, in the big movies, Raintree County and, you know, the movie Place in the Sun. And,
oh, yeah.
Movie after
Montgomery
movie.
Cliff.
And you know, in that movie, the central situation is that the Montgomery Cliff character has got to kill his wife to marry Elizabeth. Well, who could blame him? I
oh
mean,
boy.
When you look at her.
Just look at that young Elizabeth Taylor. Yeah, and he was ready to do it. off she goes. We'll hear more on that front, but have to remember her right here, right now. What a great, grand figure. Oh, the time flies. Jonathan Martin with Politico, it is always great to have you with us. Rula Khalaf with the Financial Times, thanks to you. And Jack Beatty, have a great weekend. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.